It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
Let me jump right on the breaking news. O.J. Simpson dead at the age of 76. Now, O.J., you know, when somebody dies, I feel sympathy for them, O.J. Dying of cancer. But it's hard in this case because there are two people who have not been alive since the mid-1990s. Nicole Brown Simpson and her friend Ron Goldman. And, you know, I started out, I was going to college in Buffalo. O.J. Simpson was a superstar ball player who broke the 2,000-yard rushing record for the Bills. But what happened there, not only, you know, will change forever, did change forever the way we look at him, but it was just a seminal moment for the media. The trial of O.J. Simpson was an absolute circus, televised. You had Judge Lance Ito. You had his lawyer, Johnny Cochran. If you had prosecutor Marcia Clark, you had these wacky fringe characters who testified, like Cato Kalin, who lived in O.J.'s guest house, I believe. You had the white Bronco chase, television transfixed as police followed O.J.'s car, but not in a typical high-speed police chase. But it was also a horrible racial explosion at the end of the trial, when anybody who had been following it, let me amend that and say most people following it were absolutely positively convinced that O.J. Simpson had killed these two people. And remember, afterwards he said he was going to go look for the real killers, and nobody took that seriously. But the jury acquitted him. And it was felt that this was jury nullification, that the jury didn't pay attention or chose to disregard the evidence. And therefore, O.J. walked. Now, he later was sued in a civil trial and hit with a $33 million judgment. So there was some measure of justice. And then he ended up going to jail anyway because he went to sort of steal back his souvenirs. And it was almost like an Al Capone thing. You know, he didn't go to jail for murder, but for tax evasion. But the thing is, the media went so nuts over this. I remember writing about how NBC Nightly News and Tom Brokaw surged into first place because every night, basically no matter what happened in the trial, Brokaw would lead with two O.J. stories. And it paid off in the ratings. I mean, everybody was debating this everywhere you could find. It was really the beginning of the, first of all, rise of the Star Legal commentators, which is still with us today, but really also the beginning of television realizing that these kinds of trials could get big ratings, regardless of whether a celebrity was involved or not, and O.J. was a huge celebrity. And so there were all these missing white women, and sometimes there were men accused of murdering their wives or their girlfriends. And this would unfold as a narrative, and there'd be lots of live coverage. And, you know, and then as the years went on, you saw more and more and more of this. The media feasting on, exploiting, merchandising these trials. O.J. was the beginning. O.J. was the beginning. It was the sort of dawn of cable news. But above all, it was just a sad spectacle because Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman were robbed of their lives at a relatively young age. and the media just went along for the ride. Now, you could argue that everybody in America was interested in this, so therefore the media had no choice, or you could say that the media whipped this up with the nonstop coverage. It almost doesn't matter. And it led to a lot of crappy coverage of crappy trials that would never have been national stories. They would have been local stories. Local murder stories became national because of the precedent set by O.J. O.J. Simpson, dead at 76. When presidents hold state dinners, one of the things that Beltway denizens do is they pore over the fine print of the guest list. So when Joe Biden hosted the Prime Minister of Japan and his wife last night, Jeff Bezos was there with his girlfriend. I guess Bezos is often feuding with Trump. And there's usually a couple of journalists that get invited. So, for example, Ellen Nakashima, obviously of Japanese descent, of the Washington Post, was there. A couple of other journalists were there, possibly because of who they were married to. And Paul Simon was the entertainment, a huge Paul Simon fan, playing Graceland and Slip Sliding Away. So seems like a splendid time was had by all. Speaking of Biden, you know, he has the funniest way of floating these trial balloons. So, you know, there's been this ongoing for years controversy over Julian Assange, who has been charged with leaking sensitive national security information about Afghanistan and Iraq, charged by the U.S., and then he sought refuge at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. So an Australian reporter, Assange, obviously being from that country, shouted when, you know, Biden was outside the plane or the helicopter, "Do you have a response to Australia's request that you end Julian Assange's prosecution?" Biden said, "We're considering it." Well, the president doesn't just say that, but it kind of raises the question, well, why say you're considering it if you end up not doing it? Anyway, that's a three-word answer, and that's all we know. This is kind of driving me nuts. Look, this is an obvious thing that a presidential candidate would do at this point in the election. So the Justice Department is touting the fact that it has just finalized the rules to close a loophole, and this will sound familiar to you, allowing people to sell firearms online, at gun shows, and other informal venues without conducting background checks on the purchasers. And this obviously doesn't solve the problems of gun violence. But here's the thing. And I understand, you know, Merrick Garland and Kamala Harris were touting this. It will keep firearms out of the hands of dangerous people. Okay. This bipartisan law was signed by the president in June of 2022, almost 2 years ago. So this problem of guns, as the administration lays it out, hugely important. You know, Biden's been fighting for this since the days when he was Obama's vice president. And this was the most he could get. It took 2 years to write the rule? What, I mean, you know, I know government moves at a snail's pace, but this is pathetic. It should have taken 2 weeks. So, you know, they have something to brag about now, but what happened in the last 2 years? Everybody thought, oh, this is great. This thing finally passed. I say everybody. I mean, obviously there was opposition, but a number of Republicans joined. 2 flipping years. All right. In other news, Alan Weisselberg, the former CFO of the Trump Organization, was sentenced yesterday to 5 months in jail. He pled guilty to lying under oath in the New York Attorney General's civil fraud investigation of the company. Not clear whether he'll be a witness at the criminal trial that starts Monday. His lawyer says Weisselberg accepted responsibility. He had already served 3 months out of a 5-month sentence in a separate criminal tax fraud case. That was last year. And now, another 5-month sentence. Maybe he doesn't serve the whole thing. You know, I almost feel sorry for him in that he was just the guy behind the scenes who did whatever Donald Trump wanted. But in the process, clearly he broke the law. And here he is pleading guilty again. So it's hard to have too much sympathy. Meanwhile, Trump's lawyers failing yesterday to delay the hush money trial, the one that starts in Manhattan on Monday, for the third time, this time saying, well, the judge, that's Judge Merchan, wasn't qualified to oversee the proceedings. Appeals court tossed that out. This thing is going to start on Monday. And Trump has a new Truth Social rant about this. The other day I read to you where he's talking about how he shouldn't have to go to jail. You know, always assumes he's convicted, which he may or may not be in the Manhattan trial. And, you know, attacking the judge, attacking Tish James. And that's why I asked his spokeswoman, you know, why is he comparing himself to Nelson Mandela, who served 27 years in prison? And is he worried about the possibility of a jail sentence? But the big story right now, story number one, the Arizona Supreme Court and the 1864 ban. This was a bombshell when it broke. 1864 ban on almost all abortions, except if the mother's life is in danger. And everyone's just going nuts about this. Because at the time that this was passed, Arizona was a territory. I think about 6,000 people lived there. So it was done by one man. Women couldn't vote. Abraham Lincoln hadn't yet been reelected, let alone freed the slaves. And so here you have the court resurrecting a 160-year-old abortion ban that includes prison time for anybody, namely doctors and providers, who help facilitate an abortion. So the Democrats in the Arizona legislature were trying to get a vote on this, soften it, overturn it, repeal it, whatever. The Republicans just said, okay, we're going to adjourn the session and we're going to study this. They did not want the Democrats to act. And maybe the pressure will get too great or not. But now it's not just the court. Now it's the Republicans who control the Arizona legislature. And after that happened, the adjournment, you know, there was shouting from Democrats, shame on you, shame on you. Oh, but the president of the state Senate and the state House, both Republicans, put out a statement saying, oh, this is going to take effect for a few weeks. So what's the rush? But the Republican speaker says he's not going to allow a vote on this. He opposes repeal. So clearly, this changes the stakes, not just in Arizona, which, by the way, is still considered to be a swing state, although it's a pretty conservative state, where pro-choice advocates have already gathered enough signatures to put a legalization of abortion on the ballot. And where, you know, a lot of pundits are saying Biden's hopes of maybe edging out Donald Trump in Arizona have been improved because of this. Interestingly, Politico has a piece saying that the ad strategy, and there's already one up from the Biden campaign, is not going to be ads featuring Joe Biden, who, you know, as a devout Catholic, and who often avoided using the word abortion, doesn't really want to be the star of the show here. Instead, it's going to have features, it's going to be storytelling with women who have had problems getting an abortion or otherwise are scared about whether they get an abortion or not. This is following the lead of Democratic Governor Andy Beshear in Kentucky. Had a tough re-election campaign. Stressed the issue of reproductive rights and with ads like this. And got himself reelected. Politico also points out that it's two state Supreme Courts because Florida, which Trump has also said he would like to see changed, upheld a six-week ban pushed by Ron DeSantis. You remember him, ran for president. And at the same time, that's going to take effect May 1st. So Trump was asked about this, and he said Arizona goes too far. But it's not a problem because it's going to be fixed in a couple of weeks. Well, he might be right. He might not be right. And then he said Florida will probably be changed. Well, I don't know if that's true. Conservative state, conservative legislature, conservative governor in DeSantis. Here's GOP strategist Doug High, quoted as saying, Republicans were on offense. Now, post-Dobbs, the situation is reversed. Republicans are having to react. They don't know where they're going to have to react. They're constantly responding. And the conversation is going to revolve around those places where the restrictions are the strictest. And there are also Republicans, Donald Trump is not one of them, who oppose in vitro fertilization because it creates more than one embryo. Here's Arizona strategist for the GOP, Barrett Marson, saying Republicans should only be talking about two things, economy and inflation and the border. And now abortion will suck all the oxygen out of the air of every other issue. This puts Republicans on their heels, even, he says, in a state like Arizona. And Joe Biden was asked about this, again, you know, brief exchange of reporters, and his response was, elect me. I live in this century, as opposed to 1864. National Review has a piece saying that the relationship between Trump and the pro-life movement has been on shaky ground for a while. That Trump blamed pro-lifers for the Republicans, you know, poor showing in the midterms. Remember the red wave that never materialized? But what began as a coded, quiet bickering has exploded into public view. National Review saying, oh, here it is. That'll be straightened out. And as far as you know, it's all about states' rights, Trump telling reporters as the plane engines were going. He took credit for helping to overturn Roe, and he keeps saying, you know, it's up to the states. But in some states, Florida and Arizona being the most recent examples, it can be up to the courts. Carrie Lake, as I mentioned, when she ran for governor 2 years, all for this 1864 ruling. Praised it, thought it was great. Now, not so much. Now she's opposing it. She says this 1864 territorial law should not, now that she's running for the Senate, should not become the law of the land in Arizona. Now, if she feels the need, and nobody is doubting her conservative principles, to back off from this, and maybe some other Republicans will as well. But, you know, the leadership tends to control whether there's a vote or not a vote. That's true in state legislatures. That's also true in Congress.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Hi, everybody. It's Brian Kilmeade. I want you to join me weekdays at 9 a.m. East as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and, of course, what you think.
Listen live or get the podcast now at BrianKilmeadeShow.com.
Now, this is just, I love little glimpses into history. So Washington Post columnist Monica Hess has this piece about the man who basically single-handedly made this 1864 territorial law binding in Arizona, of course. And I'm searching for a word that I don't have to bleep out. This is pathetic. His name is William Claude Jones. And according to the Journal of Arizona History, William Claude Jones was, quote, a prevaricator, a poet, a politician, and the pursuer of nubile young females. Oh, wait, it gets worse. So he begins with marriage to Sarah Friedman, who bore him two children when he would have been in his 20s or 30s. He was a member of the Missouri State Legislature at the time. Then he moved around, and President Franklin Pierce named him U.S. Attorney for the New Mexico Territory. And his wife filed for divorce. Okay, I'm just getting warmed up here. Next wife, a girl who also sounds like, oh, I see. A delegate in New Mexico who was bothered by this said that the bride was 12 years old and that Jones had abducted her. And he asked President Buchanan to fire Jones for moral failing, but Jones resigned instead from that U.S. attorney job. And then he just moved further west into the Arizona Territory. He supported the secession of the southern states. He also landed his third wife, who was 15 years old. Claude was about 50 at this time. Well, they were only married for a year because in 1865, Jones left this woman whose name was Carolyn. She never saw or heard from him again. Class act, don't you think? Then he got on a train for California, boat to Hawaii. He won a seat in the Hawaii House. He took up with a local girl who was pregnant with his child, and she was 14 years old. They had some children together. She died. He married for a fifth time, only to file for divorce later, and then Jones died. This is the man, William Claude Jones, who is responsible for what's being debated today. All right, story number two. I did a lot on this in my column and on a special report, a live Q&A with Brett Baer. But I want to come back to what's happened at NPR. And by the way, now that you have a guy named Uri Berliner, who works at NPR, has worked there for 25 years, award-winning senior business editor, taking on his own network, as always having lean left, but now being off the rails, that's his phrase, in being just sort of liberal crusaders. Well, guess who had a reaction to that? Yes, Donald Trump. No more funding for NPR. This is all caps. Total scam. Editor said they have no Republicans and is only used to damage Trump. They are a liberal disinformation machine, not $1. Well, there was talk of defunding NPR when Trump had a Republican House and Senate. Didn't happen. One of the reasons is that NPR stations tend to be popular in their local communities. And therefore, and they don't, you know, they only get a percentage of their money from federal grants. But just briefly, what Uri Berliner said is that the newsroom there was shocked and appalled when Trump was elected, and by the time he was president, was doing everything it could to damage him. There was, for example, Bob Mueller's Russiagate investigation. And not only did NPR cover the hell out of it, but it had Adam Schiff, the Democratic congressman and Intel member, on 25 times and followed his talking points about Russian collusion. And when there was no collusion proven by Mueller, they just dropped the story. NPR moved on. No soul searching. No, maybe we didn't get it right. And then you had the Hunter Biden laptop story. And you remember this was a New York Post scoop, and Twitter blocked it, and most didn't touch it. And NPR went even further, And the managing editor at the time, Terrence Samuel, who's now the editor of USA Today, said, "We don't want to waste time on stories that are not really stories." NPR wouldn't mention this because it was BS. "And we don't want to waste our listeners' and readers' time with things that are just distractions." So this was totally swallowing the laptop. It's a made-up story and all that. Year and a half later, New York Times, Washington Post, others confirmed the authenticity of the laptop. By that time, everybody had moved on. That was a sheer embarrassment. And Berliner goes on to say that whether it's portraying urban riots as examples of systemic racism, and maybe even justified, this in the summer of 2020 in the killing of George Floyd, whether it's blaming Israel for just about everything, but not Hamas in the Mideast war, whether it's describing climate change in apocalyptic terms, that NPR, almost like an assembly line, takes the left-wing position. And look, this guy Berliner, yes, the current editor-in-chief of NPR, Edith Chapin, came out and said, "Well, look, we're not perfect. We have to look into this," but basically said she strongly disagrees with his critique. Well, of course she does. And I don't know if he's blown up his career there or not. He says he's in favor of open dialogue. But it was a really courageous thing to do. It's one thing to criticize a place after you've left. It's another thing to criticize your own colleagues after you're still working there. Oh, and by the way, he quoted what he said was one of his most fair-minded journalists at NPR, who said, "It's good that we're not pursuing the laptop story because it would only help Trump." I mean, there's just no ambiguity here. Story number three, the top U.S. general overseeing the military in Europe testified on Capitol Hill yesterday that the war in Ukraine has reached a decisive moment with Russia. This is really sobering, folks. Expected to hold a 10-to-1 advantage on artillery shells within weeks, unless the U.S. approves additional military aid. General Christopher Cavoli at House Armed Services: "The severity of this moment cannot be overstated. Ukraine will run out of artillery shells and air defense munitions without more U.S. support." And he says, "The side that can't shoot back loses. The stakes are very high." A way of cutting through the military jargon. The side that can't shoot back loses. Now, this comes as Speaker Mike Johnson first refused to bring to the floor that compromise that would provide aid to Israel, aid to Ukraine, aid to Taiwan, and beefing up border security. Well, that got blown up in large measure because of Trump. Now, Johnson says he wants to bring a different bill that would support some funding for Ukraine, coupled with things that Republicans want. But it just so happens that Marjorie Taylor Greene has threatened to oust Speaker Johnson, and she really just needs one or maybe two at the most Republican votes to do it because of the same rule, the motion to vacate, that toppled Kevin McCarthy as Speaker for many of the same reasons 6 months ago. Anyway, back to General Cavoli. He said Russia represents a chronic threat and has turned China, North Korea, and Iran turned to those countries for support and formed partnerships with them. European allies have made advances in bolstering their own security, but U.S. leadership is required, says the general. So this is not some politician saying this. This is the guy who's in charge of military operations in Europe, and he's saying, essentially, he's saying Ukraine is going to lose. They're going to get slaughtered because they don't have the ammunition, which has been held up now for months because of the partisan politics on Capitol Hill. Drives me crazy. Oh, and here's another setback for Mike Johnson. GOP leaders now scrambling to find a new plan to reauthorize what's called FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. 19 House Republicans voted to block a plan to change a section of the law that allows the intelligence community to gather and sort out the communications of foreign targets without a warrant. Now, they may take up the bill again. Maybe they can flip all those people. Johnson says he may try a second time. We're going to find consensus to talk to a few of the members who are most vocal. We're going to try to find a way to unlock the rule. You know, civil libertarians and others say this is not, you know, this law needs to be changed not to allow uncontested spying, even against foreign targets. One of the congressmen, one of the 19 Republicans opposed, Scott Perry, says this has been manipulated to make sure certain amendments can't be heard. So that's one of the things they're ticked off about. This is the fourth time that Johnson has lost a vote to members of his own party since he became speaker. Reluctantly, I would say, but he did put his hat in the ring.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
Number four. It's just amazing what's happened to women's college basketball. And now we have the ratings. The championship game last Sunday between Caitlin Collins' Iowa team and undefeated South Carolina, which won pretty easily. Caitlin Clark did not have a great game. On ABC and ESPN, was seen by 18.9 million people, almost 19 million people. But the men's final, in which UConn won for the second straight time, in this case beating Purdue, averaged 14.8 million on TBS and TNT. I know the game started later and blah, 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 but that would have been unimaginable even a year or two ago. That 4 million more folks would watch the women who got so much more coverage, and rightly so. Oh, by the way, you know, Caitlin Clark is going into the WNBA draft. The Indiana Fever have the number one pick, so that team is going to pick her. And this, the overwhelming majority of Indiana's 40 regular season games will be broadcast for a national audience, including six games on ESPN, two on CBS, two on ABC, four on Amazon Prime Video. As for the NBA's Indiana Pacers, they'll have only six national games. So I don't know whether the star power will fade. You know, the WNBA has been pretty low profile, but nonetheless, Caitlin Collins has become so famous that the games that she plays, if you want to see them, you can see most of them on national TV. And finally, story five. This is from the New York Post, and I'm kind of appalled at this, but I also don't think it's a national crisis. Okay, for the first time in 75 years, Mattel is making a change to Scrabble. It is adding a no more scoring gameplay option. What does that mean? It's a double-sided version of the same game, and it's meant to appeal to Gen Z who want a less competitive version. So you flip it over, and the newfangled version is called Scrabble Together. It will include helper cards, use a simpler scoring system. I don't know, is Scrabble that complicated? You know, it has the number, each letter has a value on it. be quicker to play, and allow people to play in teams. Marketed for those who find the classic, I guess it's going to be called Scrabble Classic, to be intimidating. So, top executive at Mattel telling the New York Post, Scrabble has truly stood the test of time, blah, blah, blah. For anyone who ever thought word games aren't for me or felt a little intimidated, Scrabble Together mode is an ideal option. However, some naysayers, how dare they, objected to these changes, calling it Scrabble for Snowflakes and Woke Scrabble. I mean, the whole thing, in my view, is ridiculous, but you know what? You don't want to play that version, don't play it. You do want to play it, I won't make fun of you. At least you're figuring out how to spell things, which is a good thing. Thanks for joining me today and every day that you have a chance to listen. We posted a couple of times in case you missed the live version. It goes up just after noon Eastern. We'll see you tomorrow with more BuzzBeater.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.